Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm joined by one of the leading voices and true pioneers in pediatric hepatology, Professor Deirdre Kelly. Deirdre was born in Calcutta, she was educated in Dublin, and she's now based in Birmingham. She trained with the incredible and world-famous Dame Sheila Sherlock, was a Wellcome Fellow, and moved from adult to pediatric liver disease. She established a world-famous pediatric liver unit in Birmingham, England, and has been honoured numerous times. Among her many achievements, she's written the influential Atlas of Pediatric Hepatology and built a network of international collaborators and played a role in saving and changing the lives of countless sick children, and she's not done yet. When not focused on the liver, she's into landscape gardening, yoga, and hot yoga, which I've always been baffled by, opera and the ballet, and in fact, at one stage, she was a ballerina. This is one very accomplished and utterly delightful lady. So, Professor Deirdre Kelly, welcome.
Welcome back to you, Jonathan, and thank you for that lovely introduction. It's a great pleasure to talk to you today, and thank you for all the lovely, kind things you said about me.
Well, and there were plenty more I could have said. You've had one heck of a career, but I always like to start at the beginning. So you know, truly international lady, and we'll come on to a bit of your American adventure a bit later. But tell us a bit about your upbringing in India and how that influenced you and your life direction.
My parents went to India after partition in 1948. My father went to work for Lipton's tea, and he ended up running Lipton's in India. This gave me and my brother and sister a very privileged start to life, because not only did we have the advantage of living in a very comfortable way in India, but we were exposed to the great differences of that vast and rich culture. And we were very made aware of the poverty and the many difficulties of the people that we lived with, despite our privileged start. In particular, I think what it brought me was an understanding that everyone is different and they're entitled to be different and to be valued and respected for those differences. In our household as children, we were Catholic. We had people who worked with us who were Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, untouchable. And so we were brought up to respect and to understand those differences. And I think that stayed with me throughout my life. And it's focused my concern about treating people fairly and respecting their differences.
It's a philosophy that has been given a lot of attention recently with all the social unrest that we've seen in the world. But it's utterly true. And I think, was it Mark Twain who said something like travel is the best antidote to racism or being uncertain about other people. So yeah, absolutely. And I'm totally fascinated with India, Indian culture, Indian food. So we'll have to talk about that further. So moving forward, you set up a liver unit in Birmingham back in 1989, and that's become home to one of the biggest liver transplant programs in Europe, and it's one of the world's leading pediatric hepatology centers. Can you tell us about your experience setting that up, and what do you attribute its success to, other than, of course, your drive?
Well, I came back from Nebraska in 1989. I'd worked in Nebraska because it gave me the opportunity to learn about liver transplantation in children, which was not established in the UK at that time. So I came back with a vision, and that vision was to identify what caused liver disease in children, how best to diagnose and manage it, and how best to treat them. And the first thing that we established was a pediatric liver transplant program for infants. I was able to do this despite a huge amount of opposition from the medical powers that be, because to their minds, liver transplantation was experimental in infants and we were spending a lot of money on what was likely to be a failure. But I was able to be successful because I worked with a marvelous team, a fabulous nurse, Jill Brooke, who helped me establish all the specialized nursing and the play therapy and the education of children, which we can touch on later, and two really marvelous surgeons, John Buckles and David Mayer. And the four of us were a very united team with a common goal, which was to bring liver transplantation as a reality to the children and infants of England. We were helped in that because new techniques had become available that we could cut down adult livers or older children's livers to fit small infants. And both John and David were so expert at what they did, and Jill was wonderful at managing all the patients, that we soon built up a success. We were able to change the outcomes of children with liver disease, of whom most of them died before their first birthday, from a 40% survival to a 90% survival in the space of 12 or 18 months. And that success stood with us, and people began to listen to us, and the Department of Health gave us more money, and we were able to expand and build the team up to where it was. But the reason it was successful was that we shared that common vision and we shared that incredible determination to make it happen.
So as I recall, wasn't Harold Ellis involved in the early days of transplantation?
Very likely, Jonathan, but probably before my day.
Yeah, because I was wondering why those, and I know, and I want to come on to your experience in America later, why was it not established here sooner?
I think it was not established in, it was established in adults at the end of the 80s, but the problem with children was that they were too small to accept age and match size donors. They were too sick. So there was a medical advice that their children had to be 1 year old and 10 kilos in order to survive liver transplantation, which was complete nonsense because they never survived that long. And so what really made the difference was the ability to cut down larger livers for smaller infants. And it was that technical success and skill of David and John that made that happen. And of course, we had a role to play naturally in the preparation, support, and education of the team and the patients. But it was that really ability to produce those small cut down livers that made the difference.
Yeah, I remember when that started and reading about it. But the other thing that really struck me, obviously in adult transplantation, you're largely dealing with cirrhotic livers or maybe a malignancy or maybe a trauma or some such thing. But in children, they've got a pre-existing, usually very nasty inherited disease, and they're very, very sick and obviously very, very small. So it must be a completely different approach.
Yes, it's microsurgery at its best. And for some of the very sick children, and I was teaching just before this podcast about acute liver failure in infants. And for those children who need transplant, the surgeon often uses a mono segment. The liver has eight segments, so just using one segment, not even half a liver or a quarter of a liver, but using a mono segment. And I am still amazed at the skill of those wonderful surgeons that they can do that.
Absolutely. So there have been many changes, obviously, in medicine since this all started in 1989. What do you think some of the most poignant changes have been in the care of these critically ill children?
Well, when I started the unit, as I've said already, I wanted to find out what caused liver disease. And I think there's been huge advances in the genetic and molecular understanding of inherited disease. And so we are now able to diagnose many, many more diseases than we were in 1989. And I think the importance of that is it's identified new targets for treatment and new ways of understanding the disease. And so we can put many of these diseases right without transplantation. Transplantation still remains absolutely essential for most patients. But there's some diseases that were described in 1989, like hepatitis C, which we can now cure. And very hot off the press, I'm pleased to say that we've now got licensing for hepatitis C drugs from children from the age of 3 upwards, and we will have that available for all children with hepatitis C in England. So this is a disease that was diagnosed in 1989, which will be cured before I retire.
That's wonderful. So you mentioned earlier that you were in Omaha, Nebraska, and we British are very proud of our National Health Service. And I know that you got your beam to America, your BTA, if you will, at the time. You went there for a specific purpose. But I mean, I'm always intrigued to know, I spent many years living and working in the States. What is it about the NHS that makes you the proudest? And what did you like, not like about the system that you saw in the United States?
What I'm proudest about the NHS is that it's open to everyone and that everyone is treated, irrespective of who they are, how much they earn and where they come from. I think that's the most important aspect. And I think that 99.9% of the staff who work in the NHS come because they want to help patients and they're there for that. And that's a very open system. What I think is very different and what I like most about the States was that it has a very positive attitude. So there's nothing that you can't do. So if you come up with a good idea or an innovation or something to make life different or better for patients, they say, go for it. And they provide you with the money, facilities, and so on. So there's a much more positive attitude. If you do that here in the NHS, there's lots of no buts, can't you do this, can't you do that? And you're drowned in bureaucracy before you can get anything off the ground. So I guess we're open and welcoming, but rationed and risk averse. And in the States, you have to have money to have your health care. And I found that very difficult. You have to have your health insurance or whatever. But on the other hand, it's very positive. They're prepared to try new things. They're prepared to be better. And they're also very proud of the work they do. And I'm not sure that we're proud enough of the work that we do in the NHS. And we do great work.
I would concur with everything you've said. And that was certainly my experience over there. That's why I went over there, because I had an organization that was really looking to support me. And they gave me facilities, money, people. And I found that my peers, my seniors, were very accepting of innovation. Whereas here, I guess there's truth in stereotypes. We British tend to be very circumspect, and America is a little bit more open. And as for the health insurance, totally baffling. And there's also so much misinformation. The way Americans view British healthcare, who've never been and seen it for themselves. So maybe it takes people like you, who've got an international perspective, and you could do a little bit of transatlantic diplomacy and improve things on both sides. That could be a good guy.
I'll stand for president next.
Well, we probably shouldn't get into politics, Deirdre, but boy, wouldn't it be wonderful. By the way, I was talking to another podcast guest recently, and if you look at the countries that have done really well during this pandemic, you know, countries like New Zealand and Finland and so on and so forth, they have one thing in common. They have female leaders. So my guest on that occasion was saying it's not a coincidence.
I agree.
So let's change tack a little bit. The hospital environment, it's normally not a warm and cuddly place for anyone, let alone for children. And an environment can impact recovery. It's either intimidating, it could put people at ease, creating, if you will, a safe space. Why is the environment so important? And what steps have you taken in your institution to change that clinical environment to suit the patients you're treating?
Well, first of all, we heal better if we're comfortable and safe, without pain. That's definitely been identified with infants. Without pain, they'll recover much faster. So you need to feel safe, comfortable, and pain free to make a good recovery. That's the very first thing. From the second point of view, my philosophy when I set up the liver unit was that it should be child and family centred. And that's very easy to say, but I've been very privileged to work with people who believe in that. And so our approach to children in the liver unit is that they are the focus and they are the important ones. And so when we developed our protocols, our management, our way of caring for patients, it's very much considering making the child comfortable, making sure the child and family are fully informed. And you can counsel and inform children down as young as five and even younger through play, through books and games and different approaches. And you can also help them make their own decisions. And so we have a whole multidisciplinary team of specialist nurses, psychologists, play therapists, dietitians. But the play therapists are very key in making the children feel at home on the hospital, at home in hospital, feeling comfortable, bringing them information in a play-based way. I've found that that helps enormously, and I've been very impressed with how giving some control to children and families, even a small amount of control, is really important. So, for instance, you can say to a child, which pair of pyjamas do you want to wear going to theatre? Which toy do you want to take? Which arm would you like us to put the drip in if we have a choice? And that gives them just a small amount of control. And I think having control of yourself, or some control, is very important when you're ill and recovering.
Yeah, I mean, it's true for adults. Hospitals are dehumanizing. I remember my mum, when on her final hospitalization, was in this purportedly a short stay ward. No windows, white walls, drab curtains, light, vinyl floors, and fluorescent lights, and constant noise. You would think it's a perfect setup for torture, not for recovery. So good on you. Look, patient recovery doesn't just end after a successful surgery, for any surgery, but specifically transplantation. It can deeply affect recipients' lives. So how do you track how children are doing physically, mentally, emotionally, and the family to ensure the outcome and quality of life is maximized following transplantation? How do you ensure that the child and their family feel supported throughout treatment?
Well, I've published a lot on this, and I think it's a very important point, Johnson, so thank you for bringing it up. Children who've had a transplant have a lifelong medical condition. I don't like to call it an illness, but they have a medical condition which needs to be tracked. And so they need regular follow-up all their lives. And one of the questions that I asked myself when we started this whole process was, how did transplantation affect them physically, mentally, emotionally, in due course? And so we see them regularly, at least once a year, if they live a long way away, with shared care. And every 5 years, we have a kind of MOT in which we check how they're doing physically, whether the graft is working well, their kidneys are working well, have they any side effects of their immunosuppression, what's their quality of life, what's their mental health, how are they doing educationally. And I'm assisted in this by the same team that I mentioned, the specialist nurses, the play therapists, psychologists. And as they get older, we have a transition team of nurses and play workers who work between us and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. So they prepare the children for transition to adult life. So I think the child and their family are supported essentially by the wider team, and they do a tremendous job. We have a Liver Direct helpline, which parents can access by phone or by email. And their queries are answered within 24 or 48 hours, depending whether it's weekend or not. And they can ring for any query that they want. So we have a nurse sitting on the phone for most of the day answering queries or by email. So we make it as easy for parents and families to contact us as possible. And we keep a very close eye on them as they move into adult services. What I'm keen to establish, and I have yet to convince my adult hepatology colleagues of this, is the fact that children who had infant liver transplantation are different to adults who've had liver transplantation. And like children who have long-term effects of congenital heart disease and long-term effects of cancer, yet this is a separate group of children who need specialized follow-up. And I think with the volume of adult cases, it's been hard to convince them that these children and young people are different, but I haven't given up that yet.
In a sense, you probably will not give up. changing tack again, believe you looked at artificial livers as a way of bridging patients to whilst they're waiting for an organ, and I'm presuming that availability of organs is still an issue. How did you get involved? Well, actually, first of all, if you could address the issue of availability of organs, is it, how are we doing in that regard?
We're not doing terribly well at the moment because of the COVID pandemic, because the numbers of donors has fallen quite significantly. But I think donors for children have always been difficult. And they shouldn't be, because every adult donor should be split so that an adult can have one half and a child can have the other half. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen in some of the smaller transplant centres that are less experienced surgeons. So yes, so donor availability is a big issue. And we're improving that by using techniques such as machine perfusion, when you can keep the liver overnight and keep it in a better condition, which the team at the QE, my adult colleagues at the QE, are pioneering. And of course, there's
That's the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. And then we have the option, of course, of living-related donation, which parents or family member donate part of their liver. That also extends the donation field. But the research on artificial livers comes from my basic research into the work I did with the liver labs at the University of Birmingham with Alistair Strain and others, when we looked at the function of livers, the developmental process, and we tried to grow livers in culture. And we developed, we got a lottery grant, in fact, to develop an artificial liver using human hepatocytes. And it did work quite well, but the problem with the artificial livers is the liver is a synthetic organ, not just like the kidney, one in which you just filter. So the artificial livers were very good at filtering away waste products. They were not very good at synthesizing proteins and clotting factors, the kind of thing that you really need to keep livers going. So it was a very short-term experiment. It was tried quite a lot in the 80s and 90s, but essentially it's not many people are using artificial livers now, or we use plasmapheresis and other ways in small children to try and remove the toxins. We still haven't got anything that will do the synthetic function. So that field, I don't believe, is developing very, very fast, although with new techniques with stem cells and the ability to grow liver cells from stem cells, we might be starting all of that up again.
Yeah. Watch this space, I guess. So you mentioned COVID-19 and the impacts on the healthcare system, which has been overwhelming to some degree. Sadly, some patients have been left behind, experienced delayed consultations, maybe even their surgeries. Can you address how COVID-19 has specifically affected the care of children with liver disease and your and liver transplant candidates?
Yes, very, very definitely. I think initially everybody was in kind of fear and pandemic and everything was cancelled. But I think the positive aspect of COVID was it forced us into developing virtual clinics and telephone clinics and care away from home, which we did very quickly. Being a national unit, many of our patients come from all around the country. So we very rapidly developed a system whereby we could monitor them long distance. It actually is more work for the team because they have to ensure that the patients get their blood tests and tests done locally, which was a bit of a challenge in the early days of the pandemic, so that the results are available for when I do a virtual clinic or a telephone clinic, so that I have some meaningful information to discuss with them. But that's all getting better. So some of the positive aspects was that we were able to provide virtual clinics and remote care to the patients who did not need to come to the hospital. And then gradually we are bringing patients back to face-to-face, so that the service, I think, is pretty well normal again for most of the patients with liver disease. As far as liver transplantation was concerned, renal transplantation was discontinued completely on a national level, but liver transplantation was continued for urgent patients, both adults and children. And part of that was related to the fact that the number of organs fell and there was danger about infected donors and difficulties about ICU beds and access to theatres and so on. And also many of the organ donation teams were redeployed to the front line, so they weren't available to do the organ donation side of things. That is all pretty well back to normal now. And I think the most positive message that I want to mention is that although you might expect children and adults who are on immunosuppression post-liver transplant or are immunosuppressed because of their liver disease to be more at risk of COVID, in fact, they appear to be less at risk. And I've just completed a review of COVID infections in children with different forms of liver disease and liver transplantation. And right across Europe, China, and the US, there have been hardly any cases of infected children with COVID. And those who have been infected have had very mild illnesses. So I'm intrigued as to why this should be so, because it's not exactly so in adults. And what I think is that we know children have a mild illness anyway. So there's something different about children's immune systems than adults, which we're like to explore further. But also that I think because these children are on immunosuppression, they're not able to mount that cytokine rush, that inflammatory cytokine rush that is so dangerous for adults. So the message for my patients is you're not at any more risk of COVID than another child. In fact, you might be protected. So that's a positive message.
That's fascinating. It really is. So keeping on the pandemic, I know that you've served in leadership roles in medicine, and we were chatting about the fact that doctors ought to be more vocal influencing public policy, as I think issues with the pandemic have shown. How can we as doctors do better influencing the national narrative? I'll give you an example. When Tony Fauci talked, first of all, in the United States about masks, he was very honest, and he said the data don't really... I'm paraphrasing, really don't guide what we should and should not do. And he then came back and said, yeah, well, there are data now. Yeah, you should wear a mask. And that was taken as a sign of indecision, when in fact, you and I and our audience would recognize that this was actually a sign of honesty, right? We base our decisions on data. How can we do a better job communicating?
Well, I think we have to start by taking a broad view that medicine isn't just about being on the front line, and encourage doctors to take important roles in public health and important leadership roles, but also give them the time, space, and training to do that well. And I agree with you, Jonathan. I do remember a patient I had in the very early days who came from Ireland, and the child had a very complicated liver transplant. And I said to the parents, I don't know what's going on, but I'll go away and find out. And the father said to me afterwards, I was really disappointed. You, the big expert, did not know what was going on. And then afterwards, I realized that you were being completely honest and that you were better to say that than somebody who made something up just to appease me. So I think it's partly about educating the doctors to be competent in what they and to be truthful and to be prepared to say, I don't know what is happening and I will find out and come back to you when I do know. And being consistent in that message. And I think the problem with currently now is there's too much information and it's quite different and it's coming from different sources. And we don't really know who to believe. Do we believe the Oxford group? Do we believe the Imperial group? Do we believe Sage? Do we believe them in Edinburgh? They're all saying different things with the same data.
Yes.
So I think it's important that if people don't agree with things that they have the courage to say it, but I don't think it helps the public particularly. And I
maybe we need to explain to the general public the method of scientific discourse. You know, you have a theory, you write a grant application, you, having developed a protocol, you conduct the research, you publish the research, and your findings are critically dissected in the pages of the medical literature by your colleagues, sometimes quite unkindly, but, you know, you're pushed, right? You're pushed and pushed, and hopefully we get to a sensible place. And the history of medicine suggests that we largely do, but the public just doesn't understand. They see it as, oh, you know, they told us first don't eat eggs. Now they're saying you should eat eggs or whatever it may be. Fat, sugar, protein. We just have to do a better job. And I'm not sure how we do that. But I think unless we do, our role as the wise heads that people come to for help, we will be usurped by people who are better public speakers and have a bigger platform.
Yeah, so maybe we just need to help doctors be better public speakers, I think, and be more confident in how they say things. I think trust has got a lot to do with it, and people on the whole tend to trust doctors. In general, they trust the doctors. And I think it's been very difficult for the doctors and the public eye, really, Jonathan. I don't envy them. You know, the data comes out, it's changing all the time, and it's very difficult to provide a consistent approach.
Well, the final question I'm going to ask you in a few minutes is going to have you take the role of one of those doctors. But let's, before we get to that, in your book, you explore the diseases that are prevalent in Asia. Can you tell, and obviously, you know, you grew up in the Indian subcontinent. Tell us a little bit about the geographical aspects of liver disease in children.
Well, as you might expect, in some of the developing countries, or emerging countries, infectious causes of liver disease are really prevalent. So, for instance, acute liver failure in older children in our country is more likely to be due to autoimmune liver disease, for instance, whereas in Asia it's going to be due to hepatitis A still. So infectious causes are really, really important, and parasitic causes are quite important. So the actual etiology is slightly different. And then there are various diseases which are really only seen in India and Africa, like veno-occlusive disease and others. We rarely see them in this country. And whether they're related to genetic changes in coagulation or whatever, I really don't know. But we hardly ever see them in this country. But I think the biggest differences are the lack of access to good medical treatment in many emerging countries, in many developing countries, not just no access to diagnosis or the right kind of diagnosis or late diagnosis. And then most of these countries, they have to pay for their healthcare. They have to pay for their medicines. And a lot of the hospital admissions are beyond the reach of most people. And those children still die. They still die in the way we saw them die in England in the 80s and 70s, but they die because they don't have access or the financial resource to treatment. And I find that very humbling when I visit different centres to think I could cure this child in England. And I've done a lot to bring children back in a charitable way to treat them here. But of course, I can't bring them all.
No, any of us who've been involved in international medicine know how I use the right word, humbling it can be, and the urge that you want to do things to change and improve things. I did another podcast recently with a friend who's been very involved in robotics and telemedicine, and he started the World Telemedicine Initiative to utilize technology to bring healthcare and hopefully educate our colleagues in new techniques, and also raise the awareness of issues around the world. So this is another thing to add to the list. So the kind of work that you do, it's teamwork. You must work alongside radiologists, histopathologists, surgeons, nurses, many, many other professions. How do you create an environment of mutual understanding, collaboration between physicians of different disciplines, and shall we say different personalities?
Well, I think the most important thing is you all sign up to the same goal, the same outcome. And I think if you are signed up to that, which is doing the best for patients with liver disease in my situation, according to your skill and expertise, that's the main aspect. And to put personal agendas and personalities aside from that, I think the majority of colleagues are happy to do that. They will focus on what's best for the child in their expertise. But I think we have to trust each other, and we have to respect each other's skills and value them. For me, I know, looking back over my career, I could not have done this without the nurses, the surgeons, the radiologists, the histopathologists. And I like to think they felt valued and respected by me throughout all of that time. And I've certainly always acknowledged the importance of their expertise into achieving a good outcome for our patients. And I think they've been part of my work, they're part of my book, they've all been part of my of ensuring that all of them are able to display what they know to improve the outcomes for children all around the world. And I think we've done that, and it's worked pretty well. But you're right about the personalities. It's important to put your personality and your personal agenda away when you go to this and just focus on the child.
Yeah, I mean, I know that folks who aren't involved in medicine and they get their diet, if you will, or their recipe from television dramas. And I've told people, you know, if you were to go into an accident and emergency or the ER in the United States and see a major trauma being worked on, you'd be very disappointed. There's no shouting and screaming. No one says stat ever. It's a well-orchestrated ballet of professionals who know what they're doing and just quietly go about their job. Same in the, you know, when I trained, I do remember there was one surgeon, he didn't throw instruments, but he could be quite fractious. But the majority of times an operating theatre is a serene place, as it should be, with people just going about their job. So again, I think maybe we need to do a better job educating the general public. So I hinted at this a few moments ago when we were talking about doctors in the public eye. Let's pretend that you wake up tomorrow morning and you learn that you are the global health secretary. You're in charge. You're the boss. What three things would you do to make the world a better place from a health perspective?
By global, I presume you mean worldwide.
You're it. You're the capo di tutti capi, the whole world.
What I would do, first of all, would be to bring all the developing countries close together in collaboration to ensure that our expertise and our development is available through training and support of less well-developed countries. I don't think there is currently a united focus on developing training and of facilities and doctors and healthcare workers in the difficult areas. People are left to do it their own way. The second thing I would do is I would coordinate all the many charitable organisations that have got lots of money, get them to work together and to agree on specific goals that would be, let's say, vaccination right across the world, ensuring that vaccination and the follow-up of vaccination is, for instance, that's one of the worldwide aspects. Nutrition and infant feeding and infant mortality, those are really big issues. And I think that if we could coordinate those charitable global foundations from looking at their own particular aims, but to agree some very important common aims. And finally, I think with the pandemic still around us, I think I would try and set up some collaboration between countries to study emerging infections before they came along.
Well, three very, very worthy goals. And your last one, I was talking to a pal who's he's a veterinary surgeon and he does research work and virology is his thing. And he's one of these folks who's been saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when that we have a zoonotic disease that is as transmissible as COVID-19 but has the mortality of an Ebola. So these kind of collaborations we desperately, desperately need. Look, Deirdre, it's been incredible and inspiring to hear about all your achievements and everything that you've done for your patients. And I sense there's plenty more to come. So thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a great pleasure talking to you and look forward to meeting you for that walk.
Absolutely. We'll go see some of the architectural landscapes in up on Hampstead Heath. There's plenty of it. So that's all we have time for this week, but tune into the EMG Health Podcast next week to hear more from me, well, hopefully less from me, more from another fantastic guest. In the meantime, everyone, please stay safe and take care. Bye for now.